Gabby Stroud taught primary school kids for 15 years until she just couldn't do it anymore. It's not that she fell out of love with teaching. It's just the opposite. Gabby came to feel that the system wasn't allowing her to teach, not the way she thought she ought to be teaching anyway. Gabby, like a lot of teachers, is finding that classroom time is increasingly loaded up with the business of accounting for how you teach. And she thinks that standardisation is forcing a one-size-fits-all approach on the classroom, a room of 30 kids with different family backgrounds, different learning speeds, and different temperaments. Gabby Stroud has written about all this in the most recent edition of the Griffith Review, which is titled Fixing the System. Hello, Gabby.
Hi, Richard. Thanks for having me today.
It's a pleasure. We all want to know what's going on in the classroom. I've got kids. You've got kids too now. I'm sure you want to know what's going on in the classroom like everyone else. There's this kind of thing. How do they do what they do? The very beginning of your essay for the Griffith Review sort of shows the things you're thinking of when you're looking at all those kids. I'd really love you to if you could read the first couple of paragraphs of what you wrote in the Griffith Review, please.
Sure. Saren is six. His family is new to our small rural town. He is embarrassed when I ask him about the Indian he speaks at home. At the parent-teacher interview, Saren's mother nods while I speak. Nods again as the older sister translates. James is seven. He should have started kindergarten or prep last year. He should have been to preschool. He should attend school more often than he does. Trudy makes me laugh. She'll be six in 14 sleeps and her confidence is delightful. She does Irish dancing and demonstrates a jig for all the other students. Her mum came to see me yesterday. Trudy's folks are separating. I can feel Trudy's confidence slipping away as the ground shifts beneath her dancing feet. Taylor has just turned six. His parents are going to be the proactive kind. When I first met them at orientation last year, they asked when the PNF meetings were held. Taylor has autism and two folders of paperwork. A teacher aide is assigned to assist him, but only from 9 to 11 and not on a Friday. Funding is tight. Selena keeps me up at night. She made a disclosure 2 weeks ago. I had to report it. I've had a meeting with someone from Family and Community Services every day this week. No wonder she is such an angry little five-year-old. Ray is six and a half. He likes holding up the extra half finger to show me. I am not meant to, but I wrap my fingers around his and watch how Ray's dark skin contrasts against my white pallor. He told me once he doesn't want to be Koori anymore. I didn't know what to say about that. Making contact with a local elder is on my list of things to do.
You see, Gabby, when I read that, or when I hear you say that, I kind of realise all of a sudden that the classroom, you know, classroom full of mucky kids, is kind of like the opening chapter of War and Peace. There's this whole sea of humanity there, and every kind of human being within that classroom, who in turn come from families that represent all these different kinds of people as well. How do you keep track of each one of those kids in your classroom as you see what they do? Is it something you do right at the very start of the year, or is it something you pick up as you go along?
There are lots of things that good teachers do to keep track of their kids and to bring their learners together as a community. I have a personal philosophy that goes by the lines of, don't tell me what you know until you show me that you care. And so I make sure that every child in my class knows that I personally care about them, that I'm invested in them, that I'm interested in their family life, their home life, the things that interest them. And from there, I build a really beautiful, positive relationship where my students can trust me and learning can then begin.
So you think you need to persuade the kid that you really do care before they'll really open their mind to consent to be educated by you?
Yeah, absolutely. I do. I believe that, an education that's going to be meaningful, you know, it's got to come from that that connection between yourself as the teacher and the student as the learner. And, you know, it's a role that shifts too. These kids have taught me just as much. When I very first began teaching, an older, more experienced teacher said to me, Gab, forget everything they taught you at uni. It's all about relationships. And it was very good advice.
When you're setting up a classroom for a new year, when it's, you know, the beginning of the year, it's the week before first day of school, mm-hmm. How do you do that? How do you go about that setting up process for the year?
It starts well before the week before they go in. But so it starts with setting up a beautiful learning environment, which, you know, it's even the little things like how wide open should the curtains be so that how much light is getting into this room? Will students sitting here and here be able to see the board? You know, is it good natural light? When we turn the lights on, do they make a flickering noise? How can I cool and heat this room? It's all those sort of aesthetics of the building.
You know, this is exactly what I do when I do any public speaking. You check out the kind of the suitability of the stage.
That's right.
And how, if there are distracting things, if the audio is going to carry, if there's enough correct lighting, if the sound is going to work, if the environment is pleasant to be in, if it's all the right shape. You do this as a teacher
too. You do that as a teacher. So you think about all of that to begin with, and then you start thinking about things like, and in that first week, once the students arrive, you know, you start bringing them together as a community and you start talking to them about, all right, well, what are our classroom rules or our classroom expectations going to be? Do we all agree on that? Why would we have those as our expectations? You know, we start setting goals. We start setting up, you know, even the simplest things like just the basic routines, you know, that we will come in and we'll always go to this place first. We'll all come in and we'll sit at the mat, or we'll all come in and we'll sit at our desks. You're establishing all those routines and those boundaries that kids absolutely thrive on and do well in. A lot of a teacher's first couple of weeks are spent doing those things.
And how much do you know about the kids before they come into the room? I'm not saying you ought to memorise their details or anything, but do you know much about them at all, or do you try and keep it a clean slate before they enter the classroom?
Experience has taught me that just because you've taught an older sibling doesn't mean you know the younger sibling that's coming in. Every child is unique and different and has their own story. So as much as you might hold in your mind a whole heap of background knowledge and information about, a family's circumstance, their situation, the older sibling, you still need to meet that new child that comes into your classroom and discover all their uniqueness.
Do kids compete for your affection?
They can, especially the little ones, the young ones, you know, and I find that very endearing.
You know,
it's lovely. Oh, they'll bring you pictures. I used to call them my love letters. You know, they'd bring you in little letters that they'd written that night and that proclaim that I am the world's best teacher, you know, and they're giving you that on their fourth day of kindergarten. So, you know, they might have experienced one or two teachers prior to me. But, you know, kids have all kinds of ways of letting you know that you're on the right track and that they're responding to what you're doing as a teacher.
I think your own teaching, it has to be informed by how you were taught as well. Mm-hmm. What was your own childhood like and where you grew up, Gabby?
I grew up in Jindabyne on a farm, and my mum has described me as the late lamb. I came 10 years after my sister, who's older than me, and 20 years after my eldest sister. So my childhood was spent very much sort of on my own. I was a bit like an only child, and that sort of meant that I had plenty of time for imagining and playing on my own and roaming around our beautiful farm.
Did you have imaginary friends?
I did have imaginary
How
friends.
Many?
I had two. I had one who was a very committed best friend to me, and his name was Ankle. He was a little Indigenous fellow, and he was with me almost constantly through my childhood. And pains me to admit, but I also had an imaginary bully, and her name was Christiana, and she wasn't very nice.
What would she say? I don't know what she'd say. She said to you, but how did she treat you?
It was things like, you can't sit there in the car. You know, I would have to sit in a certain spot because Christiana said, no, don't sit there. Ankle was much nicer. He was a much nicer imaginary friend.
What do you make of those imaginary friends now?
I think that the fact that I can recall them and the feelings that I have associated with them, and that I have such rich childhood memories, I think that's what helps me to connect with children, is that I'm still very much in touch with my own childhood and have such beautiful memories of my childhood. So, yeah, I can really tune in when kids are telling me these tall tales and their imaginary stories themselves. Yeah, I can relate.
Were you in school when you decided you wanted to be a teacher?
Yes, I always wanted to be a teacher and a writer, and that's just always what I've wanted to do.
And who were the standout teachers in your school?
I did have a high school teacher, Mrs. D, who was my English teacher, and she really fostered my love of reading and my love of writing. She was always very generous with her praise, and it really helped me to recognise my talent as a writer. But I remember my year one teacher was Mr. McKendrick, and he was a lovely man, and he just had these beautiful ways of encouraging us as students. And I can remember if we had done something very good, he would call us to his desk, and with a texter, he would draw a little picture on our hand. So if we were working quietly, he'd call us over, and he'd draw a mouse, and he'd say, "You've been working as quiet as a mouse."
That's lovely.
It was beautiful. Absolutely beautiful.
I hate to ask, is such a thing possible today?
Absolutely not. Yeah, we're not allowed to draw on our students. But gee, it was a lovely thing, you know, to go home and show you the back of your hand to your mum and say, "Look, I've been quiet as a mouse," or "I read a whole book and I've got a picture of a book." It was just lovely.
When you went to Teachers College and you graduated from there, mm-hmm. how ready did you think you were?
I went straight from secondary school and into my Bachelor of Education, and I suppose being young, that I thought I was ready to conquer the world, as you do at that age. I mean, I did have a sense that there was still much to learn, but I was just brimming. I was so excited about being a teacher, and had a great group of friends that I went through uni with, and a really dear friend, Kath, who we used to do a lot of assignments together, and we would say, "Oh, won't it be great once we have our own classroom and we're doing this for real?"
Really? So, right.
Just brimming with excitement. Could not wait.
And most teachers are like that at the end of their courses, or was it just you and your friends?
Look, I mean, my experience, yes. You know, we were, and pre-service teachers that I've dealt with, they're excited, and they're looking forward with optimism to the career ahead of them.
Now, when you graduated, what was the theory of education that was prevalent at the time?
Well, there was a lot of, there's always been a lot of discourse about the best way to teach literacy. And I suppose I went through when it was all about whole language and immersing students in plenty of written work and rich conversation and plenty of books. It wasn't so much compartmentalising the teaching of language. So this education and this notion of you're teaching the whole child, and that kind of carried through to my global view of teaching too, that, you know, I'm not just there to teach the three R's. I'm teaching emotional skills. I'm teaching resilience. I'm teaching persistence. You know, that all of these things are valuable and important in educating the whole child.
What is the idea sitting at the base of that theory, of the whole child theory, about students' needs and what kids need? I mean, does it mean that it all has to be fun and comfortable all the time? Is that what it means?
I think it's about setting students up to be lifelong learners and having the skills of being a learner, to understand that they can develop as a human being, that we can learn things and change and grow at any age. It's something that I still think about, you know, and I still ponder, because, you know, the nature of education even now, you know, the kids that we're teaching now, they live on a digital superhighway. I was talking to a young teacher just on the weekend, and she was saying, "We've now got to teach them the ungoogleable." And I thought, what an interesting idea, because the ungoogleable is really not, it's all those non-tangible qualities.
Teach the stuff that they can't pull off the internet.
That's right.
Or don't want to pull off the internet,
yeah.
or what?
And about relating to others, and what to do with that information that you pull off the internet, being critical thinkers of what you find on the internet. and learning the social nuances of this engagement in this digital technology, you know. So, you know, is it okay to break up with my girlfriend over Facebook? You know, what's the right thing to do in that situation, and how do we be responsible people in this, on this digital superhighway?
So out of college, you got a scholarship and mm-hmm. you went and taught in the UK for a while.
Yeah.
What sort of school were you in?
I was assigned to a Catholic school in the East End of London, and you know, the students had these beautiful East Ender accents, and they were asked me for a drink of Walter, and it was a lovely school, and they were very welcoming, and I was with a year six class. England at that time was reeling after the shooting that had happened at a school in Scotland, and so there was a lot of emphasis on security in the school. But all in all, it was a really positive vibe at that school, and a lovely first year out experience. Having said all of that, though, they were very embedded in the standardised testing, and they had Year 6 SAT standardised assessments. And from those results, the students in my care would get a result that would determine what high school they were eligible to apply for to attend. It was certainly a damaging experience for those students.
Why?
I was told in my first couple of days there, you know, I was doing art projects and singing songs with the kids and just, you know, just having this rich experience that I'd been, you know, wanting to have. It was my first year out of uni. And I was told in the first couple of days, oh, Gabby, listen, just stick to English and maths. That's what they're tested on for the SATs. And then once the SATs are over, you can just teach them whatever you want.
What? That's an extraordinary thing to...
Yeah.
And did you? Is that what you then tried to do to drill in the... drill the kids and what they needed for the SATs?
I did. I thought, oh, jeepers, I better toe the line here and get on board. I didn't want my students to be at a disadvantage. I sort of thought they were at a disadvantage enough having a first-year out teacher from Australia. So I thought I better do what is seen to be the right thing. But immediately the moment I did that, I saw stress levels rise in the classroom. And I noticed the kids, you know, they'd say, can we still have a little sing-along, and can we still have time to do some art this afternoon? They, you know, these kids were longing for just whole learning and an experience of relating to me.
And is that stress harmful, though?
Absolutely. I will still never forget the little girl, Alice, who came running into my classroom one morning before school. And, I mean, these were Year 6 kids. They were 12 years old. And this little one, she ran in and she clambered onto my lap and just cuddled into me, sobbing, just absolutely sobbing. And once I settled her down, I said, "What's wrong, Alice? What's the problem?" The way she was crying, I really thought, oh, no, someone's passed away in her family. And she said to me, "If I don't get a good mark on my SATs, I won't be able to go to St Ursula's, and my mum is going to be so mad." And I held her and tried to comfort her. And in my mind, I was thinking, oh, thank God I teach in Australia, because we would never do this to our students in Australia.
Doesn't such competition, being devil's advocate here, doesn't this such competition kind of prepare people for the real stress of the real world, where they're going to really encounter that kind of competition and pressure that's put on people to perform? You do this or you don't, or if you don't do this, you don't get that.
Mm, absolutely. I think that those kind of skills are important and they're necessary, but they need to be presented to students at a time when kids are developmentally ready, you know, when they can cognitively understand, oh, okay, this is an exam situation. I do this for, you know, for this result, which will determine this. When they're old enough to understand that, that's a good time to introduce them to that, not when they're little ones in primary school.
Are kids being overpraised in school?
Yeah, look, I'm not sure about in school, because every school delivers praise differently, whether they have assemblies or certificates, or, you know, some schools have got kids graduating from kindergarten. So, you know, every school's got a different philosophy on that. But I do think that in general, kids are getting praised, a lot of meaningless praise and a lot of, you know, well done, you turned up, here's your trophy.
They know it too, don't they?
Absolutely.
They're so aware of that.
Absolutely. Kids know it. Kids are aware of it. And the thing that I have learnt is that when you then give students genuine praise, when they've worked hard and they've earned it, and you make that eye contact and you tell them, well done, you can literally see them puff their chest out and you see them grow. And that is something that good teachers know how to give, that genuine praise.
Do you have to like a kid in order to be able to teach them well? Because I'm pretty sure not all kids can be likeable.
I've always tried to find something likeable about a student because it will help me develop a good relationship with the student. And it means then that I've got to really watch that child that little bit more closely, you know. And it might be that what you find that's likeable about them is, you know, you see them out on the playground and their mate tips over their lunchbox and that kid will stop and help them. And you think, oh, gee, I didn't know that that quality was there in you. That's something I really like about that child. I think it does help, but you do have to work for it sometimes.
How do you get a kid to want to own their own education, to actually feel like it's there for them and it's not a matter of showing up and fulfilling other people's expectations?
I think that comes through explicitly telling them, you know, and it's never too soon to put that responsibility onto the students. So I used to call them my Dr. Phil lessons, where I would sit all the kids down and we would talk about, okay, who are we doing this for? Who are we learning for? You know, it's not for mummy and daddy. They've already got their jobs. They've already been to school. It's not for me. I've already been to school too. This is for you. And talking to them about how they're actually in the driver's seat of their life and that the choices that they'll make will determine the outcomes, you know. One of the most powerful things that students need to learn when they're in primary school is that their effort will equate to their success. So that the more that they put in, the better the return is going to be, whether that be listening or trying hard or, you know, asking questions. So, yeah, it's a really complex thing. There's a lot of psychology that's involved in it.
Kids are often hilarious without realising it. How good is your poker face, Gabby?
It's quite good. It often helps when you've got a teacher's aide in the room so you can make some significant eye contact and have a little chuckle. You can square it away and take it down to the staff room for a bit of laughter at lunchtime.
You had a father come to you to speak with you about his son's reading. Can you just tell that story, please?
Yeah, so this dad came in and he said to me, well, Mrs. Stroud, you're doing a great job with the reading. And I said, oh, that's terrific. And he said to me, yep, Matt asked Nana the other day, what's a dickhead tomato? And she said, where did you hear that? And he said, I read it. And she said, where did you read it? And he said, there, on that can. And it was a can of diced tomatoes.
It had to be Nana that he asked too,
it
didn't
had it? To be. It had to be. So, yeah, the dickhead tomatoes.
I'm going to snigger next time I see them in the supermarket, I think. Gabby, what would you think would be the ideal relationship between a school and a family? What would that look like to you?
I think that the family, the parents especially, would know that they are the lifelong educators of their child. And I'd like to see families that don't feel apologetic about walking through the school gates and through the classroom door. And I think that it would also look like teachers and principals that recognise that parents are the lifelong teachers of their child, and that the stronger learning experiences are going to come when we work together. So it would look like a lot of open communication and, you know, flexibility. It would look like teachers showing an interest in students' lives. And it would look like, you know, it would look like teachers having a life of their own as well. Teachers being able to get out in the community and enjoy their own hobbies and interests, and incidentally bumping into families and forming really natural connections as well.
Do some parents want to spy on what you're doing?
Yes, some parents do. And I get that as a parent myself. I understand that. You sort of have that, oh, wouldn't it be nice to be a fly on the wall and see what's going on in the classroom? As a teacher, though, spies in the classroom aren't a great thing. So you've got to be ready to head them off by giving them a really specific and important job, but that takes them out of the classroom so that they're not spying on things that they don't need to know about.
This is Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Radio. Broadcast, podcast, and online. All our conversations are available on the ABC Radio app or go to abc.net.au/conversations.
Today it's all about what's really going on in the classroom. My guest is Gabby Stroud, who is a teacher, a former teacher. She taught for 15 years in primary schools until she felt she just had to give it away for all kinds of reasons, which you'll find out about now. When you've got a kind of duty of care as a teacher to a degree, what sort of thing would ring an alarm bell for you, Gabby, as a teacher, that a child is having trouble at home?
There are all sorts of things, and you have to be tuned into your kids because it can be something very subtle. There are things that simple things like what they're being packed for lunch. There are things like the fact that that student may never talk, and then there are really obvious things like outward behaviours that are just not within the normal bounds. So as a teacher, you really need to be highly tuned to the individuals in your class and sort of discover patterns of what's normal for them and what they perceive to be normal. And then you're looking to sort of just to keep an eye on that, because you can't just go digging around in students' lives.
It's a can of worms you can really open up.
Absolutely.
There, isn't it? You know, I've had some guests on the show who've talked about coming from growing up in violent families where there's a very violent father or mum is just not there or something. Mm. And the way they sometimes deal with it is by hanging around school a lot.
Yeah.
Because school is the one ordered and peaceful environment where they'd feel safe.
Yes.
Which is an amazing thing to think about, isn't it?
Yeah,
it is. Is that another thing you look out for when a kid is just wanting to linger perhaps a bit too?
Yes. Yeah. I've had students that want to linger. I had an interesting experience once on a school excursion where a child misbehaved so much that I was led astray. I let the rest of the group go ahead with the parent helpers and with the guide, and this student refused to come along. And so then when we tried to catch up, we got lost. And I said to this child, I said, why did you do this? Now we've lost the rest of the group and we're missing out on a lovely excursion. And he said to me, because I want you all to myself. And, you know, that's just, it's things like that that just break your heart. And it makes you realise that sometimes the most important thing you do as a teacher is just to turn up every day. Just simply being there, your presence is what's needed for some students.
How common is it for a child to confide something quite shocking to you?
I've had several students make what you call a disclosure over the years, and it's born of the relationship that you've built with them. Once they feel secure, they'll confide in you and they'll let you in and they'll share that with you. But they'll often do it in the most unusual and sometimes the most inconvenient sort of ways. It's almost always on a Friday, and you know, you're sort of left struggling to be able to do anything. I've had a child during a school assembly just clamber into my lap and whisper in my ear that mum was harming their baby. And that's really tough, you know.
What do you do then?
Well, of course, it's 3 o'clock on a Friday afternoon. So, you know, you immediately then have to deal with the other children in your care and get them safely onto their buses. Unfortunately, that child just is sent home because, you know, it doesn't work that you just get to go in with all guns blazing and make things right for that little one. But immediately then you report it. As a teacher, you're a mandatory reporter. So you go to your principal and you sit down in front of a computer screen and you fill out a whole heap of paperwork.
And have you seen satisfactory outcomes from that? I mean, nothing's going to be hugely wonderful out of that, is there? But have you seen something that has been achieved by that process?
I have. It's a slow process. That's the thing that's the most frustrating, is because in the meantime, you're worried about the welfare of that child or their sibling or, you know, whatever the disclosure has been in regard to. I have seen satisfactory outcomes, and I've seen... you know, I've seen really and well managed and positive outcomes, you know, where systems have been put in place that have been helpful and useful. But look, you know, those that work in family and community services, they're experiencing the same problems as so many other places that work with children. You know, they're stretched for resources and time. So doing the job they want to do is difficult as well.
A lot of your reservations about the state of teaching at the moment come about through the methods of assessment. Mm-hmm. Can you just explain the main forms, the different kinds of assessments that are done in classrooms?
As a teacher, you have lots of different types of assessment that are available to you. So you've got diagnostic assessment, which is determining where kids are at, where they need to go, what can they do right now. You have formative assessment, which is ongoing during a unit of work, where you're sort of tracking and looking at work samples, observing how the students are taking concepts on board, noticing what they're saying in class. And then you have summative assessment, which is usually conducted at the end of a unit of work. You know, it might be an assignment or a project or a presentation where students are drawing together all their knowledge and showcasing it. So, you know, within each of those strands of assessment, teachers have hundreds of tools that they can use for assessment. It might be checklists, it might be observations, it might be projects, it might be collecting work samples, heaps and heaps. The most common types of assessments, though, that parents know about are these standard, formal, nationwide tests.
We're talking about NAPLAN now.
NAPLAN,
right.
Now, yes.
Where does NAPLAN fit into that scheme of things? That's a diagnostic assessment, is it?
It would be considered a diagnostic assessment, yeah. So it's basically, and to my mind, it sort of works on a deficit model. So it will tell you everything that the student doesn't know.
And therein lies the problem with it? Or is that just one of the problems to
your mind?
That's
just one of the problems with it.
Take me through the issues you have with NAPLAN, why you find it to be unhelpful for teachers and kids.
The first problem with NAPLAN is the amount of publicity that it gets and the holding it up as the measure of a school's success, the media attention it gets, the league tables that have been established. It's breaking down the collegial nature of schools and the sense of community that schools need. So that's a big, broad problem. But there are other problems with NAPLAN just on a micro level in terms of we're not looking at these NAPLAN results in context. So we're not sort of considering, all right, well, this is just a snapshot. This is what this student was able to do on this day at this particular time. It doesn't take into account the fact that, you know, the day before mum had a baby and, you know, and that child's world has just, you know, changed remarkably. It doesn't take into account that, you know, this class has just experienced, you know, there may have been a great loss in the community or something like that. And this particular group of kids was really rocked and challenged by that. There are so many contextual factors that NAPLAN doesn't accommodate.
Or a teacher might have died and have had the three replacement teachers or something to cover the deficit.
Absolutely.
What changes in the school when NAPLAN tests are looming?
Sadly, we have to start preparing students for the test. And so there comes a climate of teaching to the test. So
That does exist, doesn't it?
Absolutely, it does exist.
And this is widespread, or is this just where you, in your experience?
Look, I think it is widespread.
Because NAPLAN's not supposed to be like that, isn't it? NAPLAN's supposed to be just like, you know, a quick taking of the national temperature, isn't it?
Yeah,
just step in, snapshot, step out again,
yes,
isn't it? Yeah.
But, you know, if we did it like that, it just wouldn't work. If we just sort of walked in one day and said, as teachers, okay, here's a test, you know, the students wouldn't know where to write their answers, how to fill the form in, how to read the questions, you know. So there needs to be that whole preparation for our students, because as teachers, we care about these kids. We spend all this time building up a relationship with them. We're not just going to chuck them in the deep end and say, now do this test. We're going to prepare them for testing conditions. Having said that, there's a difference between preparing them to sit a test and preparing them for a specific test. So that's what's happening in schools, is teachers are starting to go, all right, look, we know it's going to be a narrative text type, so let's start practicing writing stories, let's try and remember some of these stories, let's regurgitate these stories on the test day.
Why is that a problem? Why is that bad for teaching?
That's bad for teaching because valuable teaching time is lost. We're teaching students a particular set of values about facing assessment tasks. And, you know, what does that do for the poor old text type of narrative? You know, well, that just knocks that on the head for any kid that wants to be a writer in the future. You know, oh gosh, you know, my experience of writing narratives as a kid was dull and boring and formulaic. You know, it goes against everything we know to be effective in teaching and learning.
What do kids think of NAPLAN? Your experience, do they dread it or do they...
Yes, they dread it. They're starting to get, you know, kids are saying, I'm getting stressed about NAPLAN. You know, we get a lot of sore tummies, headaches, restlessness, anxiety. And it kind of trickles through the whole school. You know, there's this vibe of NAPLANs on it. It's a little bit like a cloud that sort of descends.
Is there an anxiety within the teaching staff as well while this is going on?
Probably not so much an anxiety, but a sense of resignation. All right, here it is. It's upon us again. Let's churn it out. Let's get it over and done with and make it as painless as we can.
Will a teacher's career be affected by the class results?
That's interesting. That remains to be seen. I have heard of teachers that have been shifted off classes because the NAPLAN results weren't great. So we think we'll shift this teacher over here because we think bringing this teacher in will improve results. And, you know, that's just devastating for teacher morale. And, you know, and as I've said, it really does something to the collegial nature that
explain
that
a bit
is
more
so
about that.
Good I don't, teaching.
Can you explain a bit more about that? You say the NAPLAN damages collegiality. How does it do that?
Because it promotes a sense of competitiveness, you know. Oh, I want my class to do really well and we're going to ace this and my results will be better than this person's results.
What's wrong with that, Gabby?
Because teaching is about learning together, and it's about learning from one another, you know, and it goes back to, you know, some of the founding principles of teaching, you know, Vygotsky's idea of learning from a more able peer in a zone of proximal development, you know, that there's this lovely sort of soft spot that if we're working there and you've got someone there to guide you, that you're going to learn, you're going to make these steps forward. If we take that away from teachers, you know, and if we stop having conversations about, oh, what did you do to get these good results, or what, you know, how have your kids jumped on board with this? If we take that away, then we're going to just become this stagnant pond of, you know, it's just... It's very hard to explain the collegial nature of teaching. It's one of the joys of teaching, you know, working on a team with staff that, you know, you can have a laugh with and that you can just share the joy of learning with. That's important. And the kids pick up on that too.
How do we how do we assess how teachers are going, though, without this kind of testing? Do you have any thoughts on that? I mean, teacher assessment, I mean, most people get assessed one way or another in the workplace. How should it be assessed?
I'm not sure what the answer is to that question, but the current structure is that there's professional teaching standards and that teachers will gather data and evidence and run through a whole lot of checklists. The teaching will be observed and they will then be accredited that they've met a particular standard. I have problems with that because a a little bit like teaching to the test, then the job of teaching becomes this performance piece that, that someone comes in and watches, and you know, all the paperwork looks good, and so therefore, yes, you can raise yourself to the next level and you're a highly accomplished teacher and congratulations. But, you know, it might neglect to say that, oh, well, this particular student was removed from the room during that assessment because we know that their behaviour is disruptive. Or this little person who came in brimming with news about their chook who's laid eggs for the first time was quietened down and not able to share that story because it was all about the teacher performing their lesson.
I think just about all of us in whatever field we're in, there's something about the kind of nature of managerialism in the world at the moment. There is a concerted push to turn us all into box tickers.
Mm.
I think that's right across the board, I think. What happens if you try to resist the pressure to become a box ticker as a teacher?
I think if you resist that pressure, I think you I don't know. I know for me it led to my burnout. It led to it leads to a sense of futility because you stop doing the things that you know to be good and important and right, and you start doing things that are meaningless, time consuming and futile.
Looking back, what were some of the earliest symptoms of this burnout you mentioned there, as it crept up on you a bit?
The key indicators for me were when I started going to school and I wasn't enjoying myself anymore. I was turning up to school and I'd always said, oh, I go to school, I don't go to work, but I'd started calling it work and I just wasn't looking forward to it and I wasn't enjoying it. And I was having these feelings of this is an impossible task. How am I ever going to get everything done that I'm meant to be doing? That sort of sat with me for a few months. And then it built to feelings of being unable to enjoy myself. So I would be at home and I found it very difficult to relax. I was almost constantly worried and anxious about all the work that I had to do for school, most of that work being stuff that was pretty meaningless and not really important in terms of the students that I was teaching.
Right, this is the business of accounting for how you're teaching.
Yeah, yep.
What sort of stuff? What kind of metrics were you being asked to?
Well,
there's a lot of
programming. I think we over-program. We're virtually documenting everything that we say and do in the classroom, and then there's evaluating those programs, and then there's setting your goals for your professional teaching standards, and then there's gathering data for that. And then there's the entering of the data that you've collected when you've assessed your students. And then there's all the endless projects that schools are always engaged in. So there's always periphery sort of stuff going on. We had something called a COSA project, which was about collaborating on student achievement. So, you know, I had to be collecting data for that and writing reports about that and finding evidence of that. You know, there was no time left to prepare the science lesson about, you know, it might have been about solids, liquids and gases. There was no time to prepare that, you know, and I found myself reaching for worksheets when I should have been gathering up the ice cubes and the saucepan and getting things ready so kids could watch ice melt and liquid turn to gas.
What do you remember of that last day of teaching?
I don't know why, but for some reason, I really can clearly remember it was a Thursday. And I remember that I had six students left to go through what's called a best start assessment, which is done in the kindergarten year. And I can remember driving to work that day thinking, how am I going to get this done? You know, constantly reshuffling in my head where different activities would go so I could get to these six students. And I ended up having to do it after lunch, and I knew I'd be rushing the students through this testing procedure, and it was not ideal testing conditions. The rest of the kids were having free play. These poor kids that needed to be assessed, I was, you know, calling them to my desk, you know, so they had to abandon the Lego or whatever they were doing and come over. And It's all set out on these laminated sheets, and I'm running through these spelling lists and things like that. And, you know, these kids are just looking at me with this anxiety in their eyes. I can remember this little one, and he was looking at me, and it's a number identification test. And, you know, he was a little bit of a late starter and hadn't got all his numbers down during the year, and it was the number six, and he's looking, and you could almost hear him thinking, oh, is it six or is it nine? This is the tricky one, which one is it? And he did this thing that kids do with their eyes. He appealed to me, so he looked at me for some guidance. And testing procedure says, no, you don't give guidance, you can't teach while you're assessing. So, you know, with that deadpan face, I'm looking at him saying, come on, what number do you think it is? And he was twisting his shirt, twisting and twisting it into, it was almost like a rope by the time he'd finished winding it around his finger. And the rest of the class was going wild, you know, there were kids playing a quite rough game of cops and robbers, there were kids arguing over an iPad. And at that moment, the principal walked in and said, oh, Gab, Canberra has rung, they need that data, have you finished those assessments? And this feeling just washed over my whole body. My palms were sweaty, my hands were trembling, my heart was racing, and I just suddenly knew this is it. This is not teaching anymore. This is something else, and it's not what I want to do.
What did you do then?
I said to the principal, I can't do this anymore. And she laughed and she said, yeah, me either, not long till school holidays. And I said to her, no, I can't do this anymore. And fortunately, I had already earlier in the year started seeing a psychologist. And fortunately, that afternoon, I had an appointment. And so I went to the psychologist that afternoon, and she just took one look at me and said, you can't go back. You're really not well. And I was in a state. I couldn't do anything. I couldn't make a decision. I couldn't articulate what I wanted. I was really quite numb, and she rang my doctor, and she got an appointment for me, and she said, you need a break. You can't go back. And so the next day I went and saw my doctor, and I was in bed for 2 weeks. And it really upsets me to admit that, because I do consider myself a very tough sort of person, and I am a resilient person, and I'm a persistent person, and I know a lot about teaching, and I'm a good teacher. And yeah, it really pains me to think that I was reduced to that.
And that was a year ago?
Yeah, that was a year ago.
What's happened since?
I took 12 months off. Reluctantly, the system that I worked in agreed that I could take 12 months of leave without pay to consider my situation. Because I didn't want to just walk out all guns blazing. I didn't want to sort of say, oh, that's it, I quit teaching and I'm never coming back. I loved it too much, and I knew what I was doing was valuable and important. So I bought myself some time, and so I took this 12 months to think, and I spent a lot of time thinking about you know, some practical stuff. How am I going to make money? How, you know, what will I do for a living? Also, I spent a lot of time thinking about whether I could function in that within that education system as it exists right now.
And where are you at now?
Well, of October last year, I made the decision that I would resign from teaching. So I resigned from my permanent full-time position. And during last year, I explored lots of other things, and I discovered that there's a whole wide world out there that doesn't have to be as all-consuming as teaching is.
What are you doing now, Gabby?
Well, now my husband manages holiday apartments, so now I work with my husband and I clean holiday units. So I spend a lot of time vacuuming up sand and making beds, and I get to put the little soaps on the nicely rolled up towels. Yeah, it's something very different.
The job's done at the end of the day.
The job's done. Job satisfaction is very high. You walk in, it's all a mess, you spend some time in there and you make it clean and you look and you think, I did that. And you know what? You get a lot of time to think when you're pushing a vacuum around a room. You get a lot of time to think about what's going on in our world, what's going on for our students, and what kind of educational experience your own kids are having.
Since you've written this article in the Griffith Review, are there people who want to hear what you have to say?
Yeah, Richard, people really want to hear it, and people get it. That's the thing that has overwhelmed me, is that people are saying to me, I hear you and I understand and I'm not happy about it either. Parents, grandparents, other teachers, pre-service teachers, teachers that are new to the profession, school principals, the outpouring of support has actually been overwhelming.
It would be great to speak to you again in 5 years and see where you're at with all this, Gabby, and see if you've ever will return to teaching. Can you conceive that that might ever happen again?
I can, because you know what? Once you're a teacher, you're always a teacher. It's part of who I am.
It's tattooed onto your mind.
It is. Maybe for now, my role is to speak for teachers because they don't get to have a voice. So I suppose I might just stick with that for now and see where it leads.
Great to speak with you, Gabby. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.